All right, so chapter 21, we are nearing the conclusion of the Revelation. I think that what we'll do tonight is let's just work through probably verses 1 through 8. We'll see what we can do with 1 through 8, and then we'll probably do 9 through 26 after that, or maybe 9 through 15, and then, or 9 through 14, and then 15 through 26. So I think that's kind of how we'll break it up, but we'll see how it goes. So reading from my translation, and I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed, and the sea is not still. And the holy city, a new Jerusalem, I saw coming down out of the heaven from God, prepared like a bride is adorned for her man. And I heard a great voice out of the throne saying, "Behold, the tent of God is with men, and he will tent with them, and they will be his people, and he will be God with them. And he will wipe every tear out of their eyes. And the death there is not still, neither mourning, neither wailing, neither affliction there is not still, because the first passed." And the one sitting upon the throne said, "Behold, I make all things new." And he said, "Write that these words are faithful and true." And he said to me, "It is become, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the finish. And I will give to the ones who are thirsting out of the fountain of the water of life a gift. The one conquering will inherit this, and I will be God to him, and he will be my son. To the cowardly and to the faithless, and the ones who are abominated and murderers and fornicators and sorcerers and idolaters and all the lying, their part will be in the burning lake of fire and sulfur, which is the second death." Okay, so right here, we just kind of puts it out there, John does. He just says, there it was, a new heavens and a new earth. So, let's start with questions and comments, and then we'll start working through verse by verse here. So what stands out to you guys, or what do you guys want to comment on?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I think that I've read a little bit, probably not as much as you have, but I've read a little bit about Hebraic customs, Hebraic wedding customs, and also Greek wedding customs. I guess a lot of Greek wedding customs are really similar. From what I've been told from people who've been to Greece and lived there, at least similar to ancient Jewish wedding customs. And you're right, it is a really fascinating area of study, and it gives a really interesting backdrop to, you know, the material and the references. The problem is, and here is the only problem that exists with a lot of that stuff, and this is not a criticism of the material you're looking at, but this is just kind of a blanket statement, is that a lot of the cultural studies stuff that's been done, a lot of it is not based upon ancient sources that describe the customs. A lot of it was done in the late 18th, the late 19th and then early 20th century, when there was, especially when the British and the French had a heavy influence in North Africa, but especially the Arabian Peninsula. And biblical scholars started going there, and they started spending time with the Bedouin and other Arabian peoples and people who lived in Syria and the Arabs and Palestinians, Philistines who lived in what's called the Levant or the Levant. And the problem is that they had a presupposition, which was that those cultures had cultural continuity, that their customs hadn't changed at all. And I mean, there are some reasons to think that they were probably similar, but that's an assumption you have to make from the gate. And I feel like putting a lot of credence into these cultural studies, where it's like, okay, well, the current day Bedouin do this, or, you know, we know that in Turkey and Greece we had some customs that were similar to this, and we know that they were kind of similar, so we can assume that this works. I struggle with that. Even when it agrees with me, even when it says something that I really like, I try to caution what I say with, the cultural studies are always a little bit suspicious if you don't have like firsthand or even secondhand documentation from that era saying this is how these people lived, this is how they did their stuff. Now, there are some things that we can know through archaeology. I don't know that archaeology gives us a lot, but there are some things we can know. But it's tricky because there is, I'm not trying to diminish the work of those people because it was a lot of hard scholarship, but it rests upon some presuppositions, and I just don't know that you can verify those.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that they definitely, the bride's mother was definitely an important person in that society, and yeah, I think that you're right. It's interesting. And like I said, I would really love to read what you that document, because maybe it is based primarily on, you know, actual first century sources, and if it is, that's great, that's excellent. I just always try to take those things with a grain of salt. If it's not directly quoting somebody who lived in that era, I'm like, okay, this could be, and it's really cool. Other things we want to, other things you guys find interesting you want to comment on?
Mm-hmm.
In verse, yeah, it's a voice out of the throne. In verses 3 and 4, and then verse 5, the one sitting upon the throne said these things. So it appears that it would be God. I'm not sure which person of the Trinity or if that's even a relevant question, but yeah, that would be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you say that makes you think in verse 7, because he uses the term my son, that you think that makes it, you think it's God.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so yeah. When you look at verse 3 through 4, it's a voice out of the throne or a voice from the throne. And I think that that's just a figure of speech for the person who is on the throne, the one holding the throne. And then in verse 5, we have the one sitting upon the throne. Now, I've done some research on this. I haven't done enough to draw any conclusions, but it would be really interesting to see with on the throne versus from the throne, like how those different terms are used in John's gospel, because it is odd that he uses two different terms. Like, why is there a voice coming from the throne and then there's a voice from the one sitting upon the throne? Are we supposed to interpret that those are two different people? Or does the throne actually talk? And if the throne talks, I'm assuming that that's a metaphor for something, unless it's like a button that God pushes and then the throne talks. I don't know. So that's interesting. And then you mentioned him being my son. And I think that the default when we see that language is we think, oh, well, it must be God the Father who's speaking here and not Christ, but Jesus calls people my son in the Gospels. So, oh, who is the Son? Well, go ahead. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's certainly the one who is the conquering one is Jesus. But also when we go back to the first couple chapters, chapters 2 and 3, all of those promises to the church are to the conquering one, to the conquering one, to the conquering one, to the conquering one. We get that 7 times. We get these promises to the one who conquers. And here we have the final promise. And so we see in chapter 21, and this is again one of these reasons why I believe in a pre-tribulation rapture, is we see this terminology of to the one who conquers. That's recurring here at the end, but it also existed at the beginning when we were deliberately and clearly talking about the church. We see that, you know, a bride adorned for her husband is New Jerusalem. Now, we'll talk about that in a second, but that's clearly language referring to the church. So, or at least it's language, maybe not referring to the church, but related to how the church is described in Ephesians and other places in the New Testament. So, there seems to be a huge gap from chapters 4 through 18 and a half about language that's used that refers to the church, and then suddenly we get a lot of it again. So who is the Son? Definitely Jesus, but I think it's specifically referring to the ones who overcome. I think it's just a general statement to anyone who overcomes. This is what's going to be given to you. And especially when you contrast that with verse 8 and then look at it in connection to verse 6, where somebody's going to be given the gift of the water out of the fountain of life. Yeah, that's an excellent question. Let's save that one, because that's a really good question. Why would you be thirsty if you're in heaven? We'll save that for when we're going through verse by verse. But yeah, that's a great observation. A lot of people pointed that out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, absolutely. I like I said, this translation that I did is hyper literal when the tent is both the noun and the verb there. And part of that is for you guys, if you wanted to pour over this document that I produced, you would see that there's a stark difference between how the words that describe God's living are used to compare with how people live. You know, people, humans, are the ones dwelling upon the earth. God is going to dwell in a tent. And so there is this interesting contrast between how God dwells in a tent and how humans dwell upon the earth. And the word for dwell is often oikodomeo. And the root is house, and so the idea is to live in a permanent dwelling, or the dwellers upon the earth. So some different thoughts there. Anything else before we dive into the verse by verse? Well, if you think of it, just go ahead and interrupt me. So I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed, and the sea is not still, or it doesn't still exist. It doesn't exist any longer. Okay, so the first question is, first heaven... the new heaven and the new earth, are these absolutely new? Are these completely new creations? Or is this something that God has restored, that God has purified the old heaven and purified the old earth, and now he's kind of rebuilt it? Anybody have any thoughts on that? I like the shoulder shrug. So I actually this week was talking to people about this, and one person says that the classical view of the Christian church is definitely that the world is renewed. Dr. Michael Spiegel, apparently, Dr. Spiegel at Dallas Seminary, says the classic view, and he is a scholar of the early church, and he says, no, the classic view is that the world is going to be renewed, not destroyed. And another person who's pretty sharp says, no, the classic view is that the world is going to be completely destroyed in a completely new heaven, a completely new earth. I think it depends on what day you ask me. I could go either way. I tend to lean towards the world is restored and renewed rather than completely destroyed and made a whole new one. Go ahead. Yeah. Well, it's interesting that there's no more sea, right? So a couple reasons why it's interesting. One, because the ocean does an awful lot for temperature regulation on the planet, so I'm sure God can figure that out. But the sea is a strange thing in biblical theology. One, the earth, when you read especially Peter's account, Peter kind of clarifies that the world was made out of water and from water, and then when you read Genesis back in light of that, The world, God, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth was formless and void. Tohu vabohu is the Hebrew, and it kind of has this idea of like it's just kind of this big blob of water floating around, and then the Spirit of God brooded over the waters, and it began to take shape, and then dry ground appears. It is not the case that the world was a big rock, and then God put water on the rock. What Peter is saying is God began with water. And then dry ground appeared out of the water. And you would say, oh, well, you know, that's crazy. Well, not really. You've got hydrogen, which is, you know, atomic number one. You've got oxygen, which is atomic number six. I mean, you can make any element out of numbers one and six. You can make helium out of atomic number two. You can make carbon out of two hydrogens and one oxygen. God knows how to work atoms. I think he's figured that one out. But you can make everything out of that. And so... whatever God did, it's this idea that in the beginning God created the planet and he drew the earth out of the seas, and now he's gotten rid of the seas. Everything has become an earth. And whether this is literal or symbolic, the idea is that there's going to be nothing on earth that is not going to be habitable for people. Because you can't live in the ocean. You know, that's one of the problems with the ocean. You know, like, that's why I tell people that when you go to a swimming contest, you're actually just watching competitive not drowning. Because if you give up in the middle of a swim competition, you know, you drown. You can't just quit. You know, if you quit in the middle of a track meet, you just look like an idiot. If you quit in the middle of a swim meet, you drown. Well, but there's also this idea that the sea represents the Gentile world. And the sea represents the Gentile world. And that's a pretty solid thing. So what's being talked about here? Don't really know. When he says there's no more sea, does it literally mean there is no more oceans? Maybe. Or it could mean that there is no more of the turbulence and chaos that once exists that the sea is representative of. Could be. I don't know. So. Yeah. Yeah, that could be. That there's no longer any separation between nations because they'll be at peace. And yeah, so that's okay. I like that. That's definitely accurate. So.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Yeah, and only now with, like you said, we know so little about the sea, and even now with the incredible deep sea, you know, submersibles and stuff that they have, but the ocean's kind of big, so we don't even know half of the half. You know, we know very little. Yeah, I wouldn't doubt that. And the problem with that is it's always moving, so what you do know might not be right tomorrow, so... And then we see verse 2, in the holy city, a new Jerusalem, I saw coming down out of the heaven from God, prepared like a bride is adorned for her man. Just pausing right there. So because of the connection with the new Jerusalem being dressed like a bride for her husband has led a lot of people to say that the new Jerusalem is the church, that the church is coming down. And that's an interesting theory, because if that's the case, that it's coming down out of heaven, it would appear that if you look at, if you go back to chapter 20, we said that there is the great white throne judgment, and that's really like the only place where you have room for the heavens and the earth to be destroyed and rebuilt, and that's kind of C.S. Lewis's take in the last battle in his Narnia series. And if that's the case, like maybe God transports the whole church away, or maybe he transports all of the godly through all ages, and that's who the New Jerusalem is all of the godly through all of the ages. They're in heaven while the earth is restored, and then he brings them down to the earth. Okay, well, I'm not opposed to that theory, but then you got to make sense of all the dimensions of the New Jerusalem that are given in verses 15 through 21. Now, maybe those are all symbols. If they are symbols, I'm not sure what they're symbols of. And I don't think anybody else can make a good argument on that either. At least I haven't seen one. I think the best interpretation is the New Jerusalem is definitely a New Jerusalem. It's definitely a city that has length, breadth, and width, and height. But it's also a place where the church will dwell, where God's people will dwell, and that is what makes it good and beautiful. So there's definitely something about this where this new Jerusalem is brought out of heaven, and she's adorned, or it's adorned, and then we're told that God is going to tent with humanity. So whether this is a symbol of whether the New Jerusalem is merely symbolic of the church and this text is saying that God is going to have some kind of spiritual connection with all the people in the church and he's going to dwell with them in that sense. I mean, you could go that way, but I think it's just easier to believe that it's a city that also happens to be closely related with the concept of the church than just to make it everything symbolic. Were you going to say something, Ian? Okay. And this, by the way, is the high promise of the Old Testament. The great promise of the Old Testament is a restoration of Eden when God would walk with humanity. over and over when we look at the prophets, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and I think some of the minor prophets, I think, this is kind of their refrain, that I will be their God, they will be my people, I will be their God, I will dwell with them, I will be among them. And that is the high promise of the Old Testament. And so we see its fulfillment here, that God is going to dwell with people. Again, he's going to tent with them. Why is he tenting with them instead of dwelling with them? Because God doesn't have a natural house. God, you know, there's no tent that's big enough for him if he wants to get bigger, and there's, you know, it doesn't matter. So, anyways, he's going to be God, and then it says, and he will be God with them. He will be God with them. And that's interesting. That's kind of a very Hebraic phrasing, how that's written. And he will wipe every tear out of their eyes, and the death there is not still, neither mourning, neither wailing, neither affliction, there isn't still, because the first passed. So this is the second time we've seen that word passed, that things have passed. And the idea is that it's passed away, that it no longer exists. But here's the question that kind of goes back to Deanne, which is, why is God wiping tears away? If they're in the New Jerusalem, presumably if this is the church, they've already gone through the wedding supper of the Lamb, they've already gone through the millennial reign, they've already gone through the great white throne judgment, they've already seen the new heavens and the new earth. Why is God wiping away tears yet? By the way, I don't have an answer for this. I'm not trying to trick you guys. I really want to know what you guys think, why that would be the case. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, that's a very fair question. I think that's very possible, that it's kind of a poetic way of describing that sadness and sorrow and those things go away. And I agree with you on that. I think that's definitely part of what's going on. But the God actually wiping away the tears, I mean, wiping away a tear is a pretty intimate thing to do with somebody. And I think that maybe that's what's being suggested. I'm not saying necessarily it's literal, that God is literally wiping tears away. I'm not opposed to that either. I don't see any reason why that can't be the case. But why are there still tears at this point? If I had to guess, and this would be my guess, if I had to guess, we have to remember, we have a bad habit, because we have chapter and verse numbers, of when we enter a new section, of forgetting what happened in the previous section. And you guys are too mature to fall into that, so you guys never do that. But some people, some of these, you know, dirtbag Christians that don't pay attention, they have a problem with this. And we forget what just happened in the previous chapter, which is the great white throne judgment, and vast multitudes of people are condemned. And so I do not see any reason why all of the saints throughout all of history would not be weeping and sorrowful over that. Now, it seems like there are some things that have happened in between, and that also goes back to what you were saying, Deanne, about, you know, looking back and sorrow. You know, did Lot's wife look back at sorrow on the city, or was she looking back with longing? You know, like, yeah, that's true. It doesn't really say. You have to kind of make some inferences, and they might be right, they might be wrong, but if I had to guess, that's what I would say, is that people are still mourning over the condemnation of the lost. Mm-hmm. You know what? I don't see any reason to exclude that. I think that people perhaps in the final judgment look over the only qualification I would have for that is it appears that there has already been a judgment of works for believers that has happened before the wedding supper of the Lamb. Now, maybe not, though. I don't know. Maybe I'm misreading things. So I think that's at least possible for a huge number of people. Maybe not the actual church, but certainly for some. But it would seem, at least for the church has to have some kind of judgment of works before the millennium, because they will be assigned roles in proportion to their faithfulness. If we read the parable of the 10 talents in Corinthians 10, into that text, which I do, but you don't have to, but that's how I, so that's why I would say that. But the others, like the Old Testament saints who maybe didn't return to reign with Christ, and those who died in the millennium, Maybe they are still mourning. Maybe they're like, oh, I should have done more. I should have been more faithful. I don't see any reason to exclude that. Like I said, with the exception of the church, I would exclude that for the church. But we see verse 5 continuing on, just making sure I respect you guys' time. The one sitting upon the throne said, "Behold, I make all things new." And he said, "Write that these words are faithful and true." Now, verse 5 is really interesting, and it's always been interesting to me because that concept of "I make all things new" is really, really interesting. For a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons I think that it sticks out to me is the verb is a present tense. It's called a present active indicative. So in Greek, when you use a present active indicative, it doesn't, we use the present tense kind of in a similar way. Like if I say, I go to church on Sunday, you know, if you say I usually go to church on Sundays, you would say, okay, well that's something that you do as a habit. If you say I went to church, you say, oh, okay, maybe that was a one-time thing. If you say, I'm going to go to church, maybe that's a one-time thing. But similar to Greek, when you use, in English, if you say, I go to church on Sundays, that means that's something that you continually do as a habit. So a lot of times in the New Testament, when there's a present tense verb that's used, we add the ing in it in English. And what it means, what it suggests is that Christ, maybe suggests that what Christ is saying is, behold, I am continually making all things new. And that, to me, is a really interesting idea because, and this is something that people, did any of you guys watch the TV show The Good Place? The Good Place? Did you guys watch The Good Place? Okay, I'll give you, since you didn't watch it, and if you're listening online, you know, this is going to spoil the show for you if you haven't seen it, but it was actually a really clever show. It's a TV show. Yeah, it was on. No, it's not a movie. It's a TV show. It was on NBC, I think. But the idea is, it's based off of a play. I think it's a play. It's either a short story or a play. I've read it, but it's by the French philosopher. Not Camus. No. He's one of the modern, like the 20th century French philosophers. He had the droopy eye. Anyways, doesn't matter. But he wrote this story about people in hell. It's where the quote "hell is other people" comes from, and they kind of play with this idea. Well, anyways, so these people, they're down in hell, and it's actually a funny show, and it's actually worth watching. So I'll ruin the end for you, but it's still worth watching if you want to watch it. But they're in hell. And they like convince people to give them a second try so that they can learn, and then they earn their way into heaven eventually. They become good people, they get into heaven. But then here's the fascinating thing about the show. They get into heaven and they're having a great time, but then there's a crisis. Eventually everybody gets bored in heaven. And people then want to stop existing. This is a problem that people have run into. This is a philosophical problem that Christians have dealt with before. Like, Christians have said, like, how do you tell a story about heaven and make it interesting? Because there's no conflict in heaven. It's just like a perpetual birthday party. You know, well, there's conflict at a birthday party. But you get the point, right? How do you make it interesting when there isn't conflict to overcome? What do you do? And I think part of the answer is what Jesus says here, is that He is continually and perpetually making things new. Ravi Zacharias, and he's certainly many things we could say about Ravi, but one of the brilliant things he said was that with God there is perpetual novelty, that things don't get boring in heaven. Now, if we were in charge of making the world eternal, it would get real boring real fast. But with God, it doesn't, that there's perpetual newness and freshness and vitality with God. And is that what's being said here? I think so, but maybe not. But were you going to say something, Jim? I think it depends on. I mean, yeah, I don't totally buy that. If what they mean is we're going to be in a giant church service praising God 24/7, no, I don't think so. Like, God has created us to do work. I think that we will have work that we do. Not that praising God isn't something worth doing, but you can praise God in a lot of different ways. And you can praise God by creating. And I have some, when you get a theologian talking about this chapter of the Bible and what people are going to be doing for eternity, you get some really interesting places. So, and because people think about this stuff and you go to some crazy places. But yeah, I don't think so. That you ask people about this and people have some odd ideas, and not just theologians, but yeah, but these words are faithful and true. And then Jesus says in verse 6, it has become. And that is one of John's favorite words. It's one of John's favorite expressions. It's become. And that's significant here in Revelation, because if you remember way, way back, all the way in the beginning of our study in Revelation, I said Revelation is a book of transition. Everything is changing. It is the key verse is that the kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ. Everything is changing. But now it's become. The transition has been completed. And he says, I am the Alpha and the Omega. And by the way, that Alpha and Omega, that's literally how it's written in the Greek text. He writes Alpha. Alpha is all spelled out. Omega is not. It's just the letter. Now, you guys may have heard something about that in the past, about a theory on why it's that way. And some people say, well, because the beginning has already been explained, but the ending has not been explained. That could well be. I always thought that was kind of a cool idea, but it is curious. I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the finish. I will give to the ones who are thirsting out of the fountain of the water of life. Now, again, why are they thirsty? Now, this is not my position, so please don't hold me to this. But if you look at ancient Greek and I think some of the Egyptian, maybe Babylonian, Sumerian, a lot of the ancient beliefs about the afterlife, the Greeks especially had this idea of ambrosia. You guys have heard of ambrosia, right? Ambrosia was the drink of the gods, and it's what gave them their immortality. I am not suggesting that the water of life is what gives people their immortality. I'm also not suggesting that. So is there some kind of function that the water actually provides? Do we have to keep drinking the water of life, or is it like a one-time only thing? Do we have to keep coming back, or does it just work once? Nobody knows. And again, it could be symbolic. I tend to think that it's actually water and we actually drink some, but yeah, doesn't have to be. And the one conquering will inherit this, and I will be God to him. That is an extremely Hebraic phrasing. The Hebrew word for his, they just say to him, or it's shla, which is a double prefix, but you guys don't care. But it's very Hebraic. He will be my son. And then to the cowardly and the faithless and the ones who were abominated and murderers and fornicators and sorcerers and idolaters and all the lying, their part will be in the burning lake of fire and sulfur, which is the second death. Okay, now, I'm going to pause right there. The burning lake of fire and sulfur. Is it actually a burning lake of fire and sulfur? I don't know. Might be. But when we look at when we look later, we see in chapter 22 that outside the city, there are going to be the dogs, the liars, the fornicators, and all these bad people. So, are those who are in the lake of fire, are they actually in a burning lake of fire and sulfur? My default answer would be, if you put a gun to my head and make me answer, I would say no. I think the fire and the sulfur, the lake of fire, is not necessarily a lake of fire and sulfur. I think that it's symbolic of the suffering that people endure. Am I saying it's impossible that it's literal? No, that's just not a view that most people take. It's not a view that most people have taken for a really long time. Anyways. So if that's your view, that's okay. I mean, you've got really good reasons to believe that. But it's we know from right here that John has already told us that there's some kind of meaning to this. Because he says, their part will be the burning lake of fire and sulfur, which is the second death. So is he saying that the second death is going to the lake of burning fire and sulfur, or is he saying that the second death will be like burning fire and sulfur? Does that make sense? Which one is the reality and which is the symbol? No. That's right. It's not going to be good. Nobody should want to go there. But yeah, the question is, which is the symbol? Is the second death the reality and the lake of fire and sulfur describes that reality, or is the fire and sulfur reality and the second death is what we just call that? I don't know. We're going to have to move rather hurriedly here through the next section here. Verses 9 and following, 9 through, let's do 14. And there was one of the and came out one of the seven angels, the ones having the seven bowls of the seven last plagues, and he spoke with me, saying, "Follow after me, I will show you the bride, the woman of the Lamb." And he bore me away in spirit upon a great mountain and high, and he showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. The light-giving radiance of it is similar to the honored stones of jasper, crystal shining, having a great wall and high, having 12 gates upon it, and upon the gates 12 angels, and the names are written upon them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. 13 from the east, 3 gates, and from the north, 3 gates. I'm sorry, verse 13. From the east, 3 gates, from the north, 3 gates, from the south, 3 gates, and from the west, 3 gates. And the wall of the city is having 12 foundations upon them, the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Okay, so the bride, the woman of the Lamb, right here, associated really closely with the city. Is it because she lives in the city, or is it because the city is the bride? Because the city is the church? Don't know. If you, we have, incidentally, we have an example of a woman being described in these city-like terms. If we go to the Song of Solomon, right? You know, she's called a tower neck. Have you guys ever seen, it's kind of funny, it's a picture of a woman, and it's everything described in the Song of Solomon is put onto her. Like, her neck is a giant tower, and she has, like, sheep teeth, and she has, like, goats running down her head for her hair, and, you know, she's got, like, a high wall as her chest, but they're also fawns, and so, but we have this idea of describing cities as women. I mean, cities as women is almost the default description in the Old Testament and in the ancient world. Am I opposed to people saying the New Jerusalem is the church? Well, I would expand it and say, if that's the case, it's all of the believers, all of the saved and redeemed throughout all of history. But I'm not opposed to that. I also think it's an actual city. I think it can be both and. I don't think you have to pick one or the other. But I think it's both and, for my part. But the one speaking with me, verse 15, I'm not going to go through that. You guys, we've gone through some of this material before, and I don't think that requires a lot of explanation, because I don't know that I can offer much. And the one had a gold measuring rod so that he should measure the city and its gates and its wall. And the city lies four square, and its length is as much as its width. And he measured the city by the rod upon 12,000 stadia, the length and width and its height. And he measured the wall to be 144 cubits by a man's measure, which is an angel's. And the construction of its wall is jasper and pure gold, similar to pure glass. I'm not going to keep reading this. We've gone through these stones before. We did this way back when. And I have kind of a version of those stones in my office, like what some people theorize those stones look like, because we don't actually know for sure what gems are being referred to. There's quite a lot of research that's gone into that over the years. And a lot of these stones are symbolic, but a lot of the symbolism depends on us knowing actually what stone is being referred to. But here's what I will say, and I'll say this, and then we'll move on to the next part. In the Bible, when we refer to numbers that are referring to the Jewish people, almost always those numbers are literally fulfilled. When numbers are referring to Gentiles, they're not always literally fulfilled. And this is an observation. I forget who made this initially, but as I followed through, I found that it's pretty reliable. Now, does that mean that the numbers can't have symbolic meaning? No, it doesn't at all. God can actually build something symbolic. Now, if you want a great example of that, look at some of the ancient cathedrals. Now, Jim, you've been to Europe, I know. You've been to England, and you were in Germany as well, I think. Were you in France at all? Okay. So a lot of the cathedrals that were built were made very specifically to match, to have numerological significance in the way that they built the cathedrals. So they built them, they built the height of them, and they built their dimensions to fit, like one of them, a pretty amazing cathedral in France, I don't want to say which, but one of them is built in proportion to Noah's Ark, right? And they have this idea, and they have other cathedrals were built with very specific proportions. Now, I don't see why God can't do the same thing. People say, oh, well, it's 12,000 stadia. 12,000 is 12, which is symbolic in the Bible of something, and 1,000 is obviously a round number, and so that's a symbol. Well, why can't God make a city that's that big? I don't see any reason why he can't. God can kind of do what he wants to do. I don't think he's dependent upon me agreeing with his numbers. I don't see why it has to be arbitrary. The only thing I will say is this would be a really weird looking city. This would be like a giant gold cube. Do these have to be the literal dimensions of the city? Probably not. You know, especially if it's also 12,000 stadia high, that would be putting it into outer space, I think. Because 12,000 stadia is quite large. I forget what a stadia is off the top of my head, but it would be many, many, many miles. So you ask again, what is the New Jerusalem? Is it the church? Is it a city? I don't know. Could be. It's something. Don't know what it is. So it's got to feel disappointing for you guys. You've sitting here listening to me blather on for a year and plus, and then we get to the end and I can't tell you anything. But you know what? I think that's a good answer. We'll just have to wait till it happens. Yes. Yeah. You know, it's like somebody tells you there's going to be donuts. You don't worry about whether what kind of donuts. You just say, okay, there's going to be donuts, you know? So you worry about what kind of donuts they're going to be? Were you saying you worry about what kind of donuts they'll be? I'm an apple fritter man, too. I love fritters. Anyways, I really am a fritter guy. In verse 22, I didn't see a temple in it, for the Lord God, the everything holder, is its temple and the Lamb. So they don't have a temple because they don't need a temple. Because what is the purpose of a temple? To worship God, but specifically to worship God as a place to meet him, because God does not dwell with a man. So we have to have a meeting place. We have to have some kind of agreed upon meeting place. And especially in the ancient world, the gods are angry gods. You don't really, when you read the ancient myths, and I'm not saying that the Bible is an ancient myth, but when you read the ancient myths and you look at temple structures throughout the world, the gods are not trustworthy. They might smite you. You don't really want to have an interview with a god. So you want to meet the gods when it's safe. And in fact, God kind of says something similar when you read, you know, the book of the Exodus. You know, you don't just come to meet me however you want. You meet me at a certain place, at a certain time, on certain terms, because I will be treated as holy. You have to treat God as holy. But here in the city, there's no temple. There's no need to have a temple. Not because there's no need to worship God. Not even because maybe there may still be sacrifices. I don't know. But because you are there with God, and there's no longer this need to come and meet him because he's there among us and with us. Absolutely. Direct connection to verse 3. And the city had no need of the sun, neither of the moon, so that they should be lighting on it. For the glory of God shined it, and the lamp is the Lamb. Again, notice the connection between God the Father and God the Son. The Spirit is oddly not mentioned here. Now, I'm not trying to dismiss the Spirit. I'm just saying it's definitely an effort to make sure that we know that Jesus is God. John is pulling out all the stops to make sure that we don't miss that. And there's no more sun. Does that mean there literally isn't a sun? Well, I mean, the sun can't last forever. So God's going to have to either get a new one or fix that one. But anyways, verse 24, and the nations will walk about by its light. Okay, so that suggests to me that nations continue to exist. Is this a reference to what people's nationality was before, or do people continue to live in people groups based upon their ethnic origin? Don't know. Could be either. Go ahead, Jim.
Mm, okay.
That's a good point. I hadn't considered that, but that's a good point. If there is a if there's no sun and no moon, then and there's no ocean. Okay. I think you could God could get rid of those things without building a whole new creation, but it certainly would make sense for him to just start fresh. So yeah, I think that makes good sense. Yeah. I don't know. Vernon McGee, his take was that at this point there will be a heavenly language, and all the nouns and verbs and everything will communicate exactly what we mean, and there will be no more miscommunication, no more misunderstanding. There's definitely something to be said for that, and I tend to agree with him. I'm not sure what that looks like or how we achieve that. But yeah, I don't know. Because that right there gets to a really deep philosophical idea, which is this. The only way that we can have communication where there's no misunderstanding is if we have comprehensive knowledge of everything we talk about, so that we actually understand what the thing is in itself. That's a concept. If you guys speak any German, there was a philosopher who talked about Ding an sich. Ding an sich. And Ding an sich is to understand the thing in itself. So when it's philosophers, it sounds really stupid until you start thinking about the implications, then you realize it's not stupid. What is a cup? Right? Like, what is a cup? What does it mean to be a cup? What is cupness? Now, funny story, right? So I won't tell that story about Diogenes, but look up Diogenes and Plato and the essence of emptiness, and you'll laugh. But so if I'm going to use a word and I'm going to use mug, and we're going to have a heavenly word of mug, and there's going to be no confusion between me and you about exactly what I mean, we have to understand what this is perfectly, so that there's no misunderstanding between us. Otherwise, we will still need to explain ourselves and kind of have a continued conversation. I'm comfortable with either, because I'm comfortable with God creating a perfect language. But I kind of don't like that idea, because if we had comprehensive knowledge of everything, that would certainly suggest that we have infinite knowledge, that we would be omniscient, that we would be like God. And I'm not sure that I like that idea. Not that I dislike it. I would love to know everything. But I don't know that we do. And to me, the only way that we have a perfect language is if we do know everything. But the problem is, like you said, if the curse of Babel is undone, which I believe it is,
Yeah, there is no confusion with God.
Well, the idea of perfect is an interesting one, because in most languages, and in fact even in English until fairly recent, perfect did not mean impossible to improve. Perfect just meant complete. Like, you could have a perfect breakfast. That's a terrible example, but you could have a perfect breakfast in the sense that, well, this breakfast is complete. It has everything that you want. Does that necessarily mean that it was a breakfast so good that there has never been a better breakfast and it would be impossible to have a better breakfast? No, it just means that it's complete. And our Constitution, is it the Constitution or the Declaration? A more perfect union. Modern day school, when you go to school today, they make fun of that. They're like, well, how can something be more perfect? Well, that's actually language straight out of the ancient Greek philosophers. They constantly talked about creating more perfect cities. To them, and to the Jews as well, perfection was something that could be increased. So to us, that sounds bad, but to the Greeks and to the Jews, for us to be perfect and then to continually become more perfect, that was totally acceptable to them. That we will be made like Christ, we will be made without sin, and so we'll be perfect in that sense. But we'll continually and forever be made perfecter and perfecter, because we'll become more like Jesus. I know that perfecter bugs you. It's bad English, but it's good theology. And so that's why with the language thing, I struggle because I want to agree with you that we will have no confusion. But I also want to disagree with you because the only way to avoid confusion is for us to have omniscience. So here's what I will do. I will talk to, this might be a PhD dissertation. I might need to write this down so I don't forget to write this. But I'll talk to some of my scholar friends and ask them, hey, what do you guys think about this? Because this is like, this is right up some of their alleys. I mean, this is a really good question. Well, why did they build a Tower to Babel? Well, they built the Tower of Babel because they wanted to make a name for themselves. They said they were building it up to heaven, up to the heavens. Yeah, were they trying to reach God? I don't know. It is. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I don't know. That's a really interesting thought. My answer tends to be that people will still live in people groups. They will still live in geographical groups, that they will be perfected. And C.S. Lewis talks about this idea in his Space Trilogy. I have a copy of it if anybody wants to read it. But he talks about how, he also deals with this in The Last Battle. Again, The Last Battle in the Narnia series, where every nation has, you guys might have heard this expression, they call it like the genius of a nation. And by genius, they don't mean like the smartest guy in that nation or the smartest girl. They mean kind of the heart, the central idea, the motivating factor of that nation. And so Lewis talks about, you know, for England, the true genius of England is Camelot. When God restores everything, when the new heavens and the new earth are here, England and the English will have a true Camelot, that Camelot will be there. And he says, France, reason will truly reign in France, true reason. And the genius of every nation will truly be fulfilled. And I there's something appealing to that. I like Ohio. I like living here. I would like to live in a perfected Ohio, you know. It gets cold. I like the cold. In heaven, I think that, yeah, anyways. But you guys get the idea. Does it mean simply that the nations, is it simply symbolic language speaking about vast numbers of people? Could be. Does it mean that all of the people who were not Jews at one time are now in heaven and they're fulfilling their purpose? Could be. Does it mean that nations continue to exist in geographical regions? Could be. Yeah. But what we do know, as Jim mentioned, is that there is not going to be anything bad here. And so I gave you a lot of non-answers tonight, but the one thing we know is it's going to be good. And so don't go to the other place. So any other final comments, concerns, questions, queries, quandaries, quarrels? All right. Well, thank you guys very much. God bless you, and I will see you on Sunday.